vast majority, if you're participating because of Taylor Swift, you're probably voting for the person Taylor Swift is endorsing. And then in addition to new young voters registering, maybe her endorsement of Biden convinces an additional 30,000. This is just in Florida, an additional 30,000 Floridians to vote Biden. We'll call it 5% of swing voters. So you've got your 120 new and 30 swing. So that's about 150,000 vote swing. Now, the problem is that the margin for Trump in 2020 was actually bigger. Florida 2020 presidential results. I should have had it in front of me, but I don't. It was a margin of about 300 and something thousand. So just kind of like if she increases young registration by 10% and flips 5% of swing voters, that's half the margin in Florida. You'd need pretty optimistic numbers to say that it's likely Taylor Swift could flip Florida. But the reason Republicans are so afraid is that the numbers may be even bigger. It may not be likely, but it's one of these more extreme scenarios where the downside is so catastrophic for Republicans that they have to take it seriously. And we know they're taking it seriously because right wing media just continues to flip out about Taylor Swift. If they didn't see this as a threat, they wouldn't be talking about it nonstop. And we had that funny video about a week or 2 weeks ago of Tennessee Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn, who was directly targeted by Taylor Swift in the past, asked about Swift, declining to say anything too negative about her. So if you need to know anything about how seriously they're taking this, it's that even people directly targeted by Swift are still being nice to her. So for as long as they're afraid, it's a good thing for the left. Even if Taylor Swift can't single-handedly flip Florida for Biden, the fact that they're talking about it is also a good sign. It's a sign they'll have to devote resources to keeping Florida, which maybe will take them away from some other state. All of this is very good. I don't care about Taylor Swift's music. I'm not super interested in her cultural cachet, but to the extent that she's registering voters, I'm interested. We've talked before about the debunked conspiracy theory that Michelle Obama will replace Joe Biden on the 2024 Democratic presidential ticket. When Vivek Ramaswamy brought this up, it was mentioned to him by me that Michelle has said she's not running. She's not interested. And Vivek said, well, it may not even be up to her, which is a really weird thing to say. This is a fascinating clip. Fox News host Stuart Varney interviewed political strategist from the Republican side, Karl Rove. And Karl Rove immediately shot down the idea of Michelle Obama. Now, interestingly, in the clip we're about to watch, Karl Rove says, I do think Joe Biden won't be the nominee. It's just that the Michelle Obama piece is a baseless conspiracy theory. Check this out. This is interesting.
Well, can you deal with this quickly? I keep hearing that Michelle Obama will be shifted into the... No, you're shaking your head. It's not going to happen?
No, look. She hates politics. Read her autobiography. She didn't want her husband to run for the state Senate. She didn't want him to run for the president. She is not a political animal. And besides, look, Barack Obama was my charge at the White House. I dealt with him for 3 years. He's a smart guy. He would know that if Michelle Obama woke up tomorrow and said, you know what, I've decided after a life of hating politics, I want to be the vice presidential running mate or run for president. People would say, you know what, that's Barack trying to get a third term as president, and they wouldn't go for it. But the starting point is she hates politics. This is a weird obsession of the of a conspiratorial right, and it's just lunacy, pure lunacy. I had to deal with this in 2020.
Folks, this is a Republican saying this.
When this was running through the President Trump's reelection campaign, they thought somehow or another Biden was going to be pushed aside by Obama. Andrew Cuomo was going to be the Democratic candidate, and his running mate was going to be Michelle Obama. And you know, I told the Trump people, including the president himself, this is sheer utter lunacy. Starting with the fact she hates politics. Period. She loves the life she's got.
So we know exactly where you stand, Karl Rove. Thanks for sharing that with us. Emphatically, we like
Thank
that.
Thank you, Stuart.
Thanks, Karl. See you later.
Yeah, Stuart just super impressed with how emphatic there Karl Rove was. Listen, Michelle Obama said she's not running. There's no evidence she's running. There's no evidence that anyone can push Biden aside at this point in time. There is, of course, the question of when you have an 80-year-old and a nearly 80-year-old running, there is some reality about life expectancy. And that is not any different for Biden than it is for Trump. Trump just a little bit younger, but certainly far less healthy when it comes to his physical health. That's a real and legitimate story. There's a real and legitimate story about when does the Democratic Party move on to what would be the next generation? And it's funny when
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We cannot stand by and let this continue. We need a lasting ceasefire now. This war must end.
Jordanian King Abdullah meets with President Biden at the White House and calls for a ceasefire in Gaza as Israel continues to threaten to invade Rafah, where over a million Palestinians have sought refuge. We'll speak to a doctor who's just left Gaza. Then climate scientist Michael Mann, a jury has awarded him $1 million after he sued two right-wing critics for defamation.
I hope that this draws a line in the sand. It's one thing to disagree with scientific findings, but it's something else entirely to engage in bad faith, ideologically driven attacks on scientists that misrepresent their work, that make false allegations against them, simply to serve some political agenda.
But first, could Indonesia be headed back to military rule? A notorious former general who's been implicated in mass killings in East Timor, Papua, and Aceh could win Wednesday's election after getting the backing of the Indonesian government, despite his history of staging multiple coups. We'll speak with longtime investigative journalist Alan Nairn in Jakarta. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. International pressures mounting against Israel's planned ground invasion of Rafah, which now hosts more than 1 million displaced Gazans who were once told the southern area was a safe zone. President Biden spoke Monday after meeting with Jordan's King Abdullah at the White House.
The King and I also discussed the situation in Rafah. As I said yesterday, our military operation in Rafah, the major military operation in Rafah, should not proceed without a credible plan for ensuring the safety and support of more than 1 million people sheltering there.
Biden quickly corrected himself after describing Israel's operation in Rafah as, quote, our operation. Biden also said his administration's working on a six-week ceasefire in Gaza. CIA Director William Burns is in Cairo for more truce talks. Despite Biden's comments, he's refused to impose any conditions on billions of dollars the U.S. continues to send to Israel. This is National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby being questioned by a reporter.
Has the president ever threatened to strip military assistance from Israel if they move ahead with a Rafah operation that does not take into consequence what happens with civilians?
We're going to continue to support Israel. They have a right to defend themselves against Hamas, and we're going to continue to make sure they have the tools and the capabilities to do that.
Israeli airstrikes in Rafah already killed at least 100 people overnight into Monday, as the IDF carried out a rescue operation to free two Israeli Argentine hostages. This is a young Palestinian girl injured and lost her father in the Israeli strikes.
We were in the tent, me and all my family, when the bullets came at us. My father went to see what's happening and said there were strikes, and a strike happened while he was talking. We all fled. My father was martyred. While in the car, he kept saying, I bear witness that there is one God, and he died.
Amnesty International says Rafah's population has seen a five-fold increase since the Israeli assault started on October 7th. In a new report, Amnesty's calling for a war crimes investigation into Israeli strikes in Rafah in December and January that killed nearly 100 civilians, almost half of them children. This comes as Palestinian health officials say Israeli forces have killed over 12,300 children in the Gaza Strip in just over 4 months. Meanwhile, Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank continues to intensify. At least 22 people, including a child, were arrested in overnight raids in Jenin and other areas. There have been over 7,000 arrests in the occupied West Bank since October 7th. Detained Palestinians say they're being violently attacked in prison. Meanwhile, a group of UN special rapporteurs says Israel's undercover killings of three Palestinian men at the Ibn Sina Hospital in Jenin last month may amount to extrajudicial killings and violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law. The UN experts said, quote, by disguising themselves as seemingly harmless, protected medical personnel and civilians, the Israeli forces also prima facie committed the war crime of perfidy, unquote. Perfidy describes a deception involving an abuse of good faith. Protesters took to the streets around the United States Monday as fear mounts over an all-out attack in Rafah. Rallies took place outside the White House in Washington, D.C., in Los Angeles, and other major cities. Around 20 activists with Sunrise Movement were arrested as they occupied Biden's Wilmington, Delaware campaign headquarters, warning he's at risk of losing millions of youth votes in November. Here in New York, protesters blocked cars around Grand Central. Activists led by Jewish American groups rallied outside Senator Chuck Schumer's office. Earlier in the day, protesters gathered for an emergency protest at Union Square, led by the group Within Our Lifetime. Democracy Now! Is there.
My name is Nardine Keswani. We cannot sit by idly and watch our people be massacred, and we will do whatever it takes to stop it. We will continue to protest. They shut down our Instagram page. The police are starting to be more brutal, more horrific with their arrests and attacks on the movement to free Palestine in an effort to shut us down, because public opinion shows, these protests shows, that the people of New York City and the people of the United States stand with Palestine.
The U.S. Senate passed a $95 billion military funding package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan in the pre-dawn hours this morning. But the bill's fate remains unclear after House Speaker Mike Johnson dismissed the measure over its failure to include hardline immigration restrictions. This comes after Johnson and other Republicans rejected an earlier version of the bill, which did contain the border crackdown they demanded. Johnson has told Republican Congress members he will call a House vote on a standalone funding bill for Israel. Donald Trump has asked the Supreme Court to intervene and halt a D.C. appeals court ruling that rejected Trump's claims of total immunity for his actions following his 2020 election loss. Special counsel Jack Smith has charged Trump on four counts over his efforts to overturn the election. Two lower courts have already rejected Trump's presidential immunity argument. Trump's lawyers are also asking the D.C. court to reconsider his claim with its full panel of judges. In related news, the judge overseeing Georgia's election subversion case against Donald Trump said Monday District Attorney Fannie Willis could be disqualified over her past romantic relationship with the lead prosecutor in the case if she benefited financially. A hearing on the matter has been scheduled for Thursday. In India, police fired tear gas at thousands of farmers marching toward New Delhi, protesting for better working protections and to be paid a higher value for their crops. Police sealed several entry points into New Delhi with barricades of barbed wire, cement blocks, and spikes. Some of the protesters were arrested. This is a leader with the Punjab Farmers Union.
See how peacefully the farmers are marching, yet the police are dropping tear gas shells from drones hovering in the sky.
In Trinidad and Tobago, officials declared a national emergency Sunday after a massive oil spill caused by an overturned vessel blackened several miles of Tobago's southern shores, covering beaches with thick oil. It's still unclear how much oil has spilled, while the government has yet to identify the owner of the largely submerged vessel found off the coast last week. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, protests broke out Monday near UN offices and Western embassies in the capital, Kinshasa, as anger mounts over the worsening violence and humanitarian crisis in eastern Congo. Demonstrators burned U.S. and other flags denouncing Western nations' support of Rwanda, which is accused of backing the M23 militia and their complicity in the conflict.
We are claiming our rights. France and the United States are fostering the war in the eastern DRC by supporting the rebellion. A country like Rwanda cannot fight against the Democratic Republic of Congo. We are marching. We are not breaking or destroying people's property. But the head of the police is sending his officers to chase us away.
This comes as thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes as M23 advanced toward Goma, a key city in eastern Congo. And back here in New York, voters in Long Island and a small section of Queens are casting ballots today to fill the open seat left by disgraced Republican Congressmember George Santos. The U.S. House voted to expel Santos in December over campaign finance violations and his many lies about his personal and work history. On the ballot is former Democratic Congressmember Tom Suozzi, who previously held the seat and is pitching himself as a centrist. The Republican candidate is Mazie Pilip, a Nassau County legislator who's actually a registered Democrat. She was born in Ethiopia and airlifted to Israel as part of Operation Solomon, where she fought in the Israeli military before moving to the U.S. Republicans control 219 seats in the U.S. House compared to 212 for Democrats. Four House seats are currently vacant. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Indonesia, the scene of two of the 20th century's epic slaughters, may be on the verge of a return to army rule at the hands of its most notorious general. General Prabowo Subianto, a longtime U.S. protege implicated in the country's massacres, once mused about becoming a fascist dictator and is now a serious threat to assume the presidency. Those are the opening two paragraphs of a new article in The Intercept by the award-winning journalist Alan Nairn, who spent decades covering Indonesia and the country it occupied for a quarter of a century, East Timor. Alan is joining us now from Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, ahead of Wednesday's election in Indonesia. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Alan. Why don't you start off by just laying out the scene of what's about to happen tomorrow and who exactly Prabowo is?
Well, General Prabowo is the most notorious massacre general in Indonesia, and he's also the general who was closest to the U.S. as he was carrying out his mass killings, abductions of activists, and systematic tortures. He was also the son-in-law of the former dictator of Indonesia, General Suharto. Prabowo described himself to me as the American's fair-haired boy. He mused about becoming a fascist dictator. He told me Indonesia is not ready for democracy. And he described in detail how he received training from the U.S. at Fort Benning and Fort Bragg, how when in 1998 Suharto was falling, and he, Prabowo, was in the process of kidnapping activists, he was in regular consultation with the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. In fact, Prabowo told me that he reported to the U.S. DIA at least once a week. He also described how under a Pentagon program known as JSET, Joint Combined Exchange and Training, he, General Prabowo, brought fully armed troops into Indonesia on at least 41 occasions. And Pentagon documents back up Prabowo's account. According to the general and those Pentagon documents, while the U.S. troops were in Indonesia, after, as the Pentagon put it, Prabowo opened the door to them, they started doing reconnaissance and making plans, contingency plans, for a possible future U.S. invasion of Indonesia, as Prabowo put it to me, for the invasion contingency. So these armed U.S. troops, which Prabowo brought in to Java and Sumatra and other places in Indonesia, were laying the groundwork for a future U.S. invasion if the U.S. chose to do that. This is particularly interesting since Prabowo styles himself, as he's running for president now, as a nationalist. And he attacks anyone who opposes him as an Antek Asing, a foreign lackey, when in fact he is the one who was closest to the U.S., who was helping the U.S. plan for an invasion, and who in more recent years helped to kill a workers' rights lawsuit against Freeport-McMoRan, the American mining giant, which is stripping the hills and forests of de facto occupied West Papua. And he is the general, most importantly, who led many of the massacres in East Timor. After the Indonesian army invaded with the green light from President Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger, in one case in the village of Kraras, Prabowo and his forces killed hundreds of fleeing civilians. He later was involved in other massacres and directing assassinations of political activists in Aceh and West Papua. And now he may be on the verge of assuming the presidency. He's tried for many years to seize power. He's tried multiple coup attempts. But this time he has the backing of the incumbent government, the incumbent civilian president, Joko Widodo, Jokowi, and the state apparatus is being put behind General Prabowo. The army and police are going out and intimidating poor people at the neighborhood level, telling them that if they don't vote for Prabowo, the authorities will know about it and they'll be in trouble. People are being threatened with having their, poor people are being threatened with having their government rations of rice and cooking oil cut off if they don't vote for Prabowo. Academics who recently spoke out against this use of state power to elect, to push this general into office are now being visited and intimidated by the police. And last Wednesday, there was a meeting of that included army generals and intelligence officials, where they discussed a plan to, if necessary, do voter fraud to push General Prabowo over the 50% threshold he will need in order to win in tomorrow's election. It's a three-candidate election. And if he gets over the 50% threshold and gets a sufficient number of votes in the provinces outside Java, he will automatically become the president-elect. And the plan that was discussed at that meeting among those senior military and intelligence officials was that there was an existing plan to do fraud, if necessary, to push the general over that threshold and impose him on Indonesia as their new president, really their new ruler.
Alan, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that the incumbent president, Joko Widodo, is backing Prabowo. How do you explain this change since he defeated the general in two previous elections and once talked about actually holding him on trial for war crimes?
Right. It's a very important question, and it has a lot of Indonesians outraged. When Jokowi defeated Prabowo the first time around in 2014, he, the incumbent president, the civilian Jokowi, had the support of many massacre survivors and human rights activists. And they did, internally, the Jokowi government did talk about putting General Prabowo and other generals like General Wiranto and General Hendro Priyono on trial for war crimes. I've been publicly calling for that for years, and also calling for their U.S. sponsors to be tried for war crimes. And in fact, in the early years of the Jokowi administration, I met with some of his advisors in the palace and discussed this with them. And what they kept saying was, yes, yes, but it will take time. This is very dangerous. We have to go slowly. But they said that that was the direction they were moving in. However, they never got there. They never even attempted to stage the trials. And then in 2019, after Jokowi defeated General Prabowo for the second time, Prabowo staged the latest of his many coup attempts by backing street riots that involved mass looting and burning in Jakarta. And it was at that point that President Jokowi said enough. He couldn't take it anymore. And according to intermediaries from both sides, from both the Prabowo and the Jokowi side, Jokowi then decided to bring Prabowo into the tent in the hope that if he did that, if he brought him inside the government, that would put an end to the coup threats and the incited street riots. And in fact, it did. He brought Prabowo in. He made him minister of defense. And the two then grew close. Their interests coincided. Jokowi, the president, became increasingly wealthy. Prabowo backed the Indonesian military policy of killing civilians in de facto occupied West Papua, where there is strong sentiment for independence. And this time around, when this next round of elections was coming up, the incumbent civilian president Jokowi decided he wanted to try to extend his own term, even though there's a two-term limit, as in the United States. He looked into options for maybe getting a third term or maybe postponing the elections, but he wasn't able to pull those off. So he made a deal with General Prabowo, with this massacre general, who was responsible for the slaughter of thousands and thousands of civilians across Indonesia and in occupied East Timor. President Jokowi made a deal to back him and use the state apparatus to help install him as president. And Jokowi lent his own son, Gibran, to General Prabowo as his vice presidential running mate. And he did that even though the son of the president is too young to be vice president under Indonesian law. There's an age limit. He's only 36. You have to be a minimum age of 40. But he strong-armed that through the Supreme Court, where the president's brother-in-law was the chief justice. He strong-armed it through the Electoral Commission. Official state bodies have already ruled that those two actions were unethical, but it doesn't matter. The current ticket is General Prabowo, the massacre general, and Gibran, the president's underage son. And the whole state apparatus is being mobilized, on the one hand, to intimidate and threaten the poor with trouble and the cutoff of their food and their cooking oil if they don't vote for Prabowo. And on the other hand, mounting a very sophisticated, very disgusting public relations campaign, which portrays this notorious general as a gamoy, a fat, adorable cartoon character who in videos and in ads can be seen dancing. And to people who are not familiar with the history of the massacres, two of the worst slaughters of the 20th century, the U.S.-backed massacre when the army first seized power in 65 of anywhere from 400,000 to a million civilians, and then the murder of a third of the population by the invading Indonesian army in Timor with U.S. weapons and backing, and not familiar with Prabowo's role in that slaughter in Timor and elsewhere, to those people, because, you know, these matters are not discussed in the schools or in the state media. The ads have some impact, and that combined with the intimidation makes him a strong threat to take power in the election.
Well, Alan, specifically, you mentioned how Prabowo has sought to rebrand himself. But what of the youth of Indonesia, who now make up 52% of the electorate, those under 40? How have they been suckered into this narrative?
I don't hear anything.
We're going to have to go to a break, Juan, because it looks like the IFB dropped for Alan. We're going to then come back to speak with him. Alan Nairn, longtime investigative journalist who's been covering Indonesia for decades. He's speaking to us from Jakarta, Indonesia. He's written a piece in The Intercept headlined, "Indonesia's State Apparatus is Preparing to Throw Election to a Notorious Massacre General." We'll be back with him in a minute. Oh.
笑顔で見てしょ Tengo dudas Porque sé Es una fantasía En mi pecho
The group El Lado Negro, they signed on to Artists for Ceasefire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue our conversation with longtime investigative journalist Alan Nairn, who's covered Indonesia and Indonesian-occupied East Timor for decades. His piece in The Intercept, Indonesia State Apparatus is Preparing to Throw Election to a Notorious Massacre General. Juan?
Yes, Alan, before we lost you, I was asking you, you had mentioned the Prabowo's attempts to rebrand himself, and I asked about the young voters of Indonesia, who make up about 52% of the electorate. How have they bought into this narrative? And also, what does it say about a democratic elections that a general with this kind of record is likely to be be victorious in an election?
Well, we don't yet know if he's likely, but he's a strong threat to win because the muscle of the state apparatus is behind him. Part of the reason they to some extent can get away with that because textbooks and the press are not honest about how the army originally came to power. With the U.S.-backed slaughter in 1965 of anywhere to 400,000 to a million civilians, and then the invasion of East Timor with U.S. green light and weapons, where they killed a third of the population, which was the most intensive proportional slaughter since the Nazis. And they're definitely not familiar with General Prabowo's role in Timor and in the Aceh assassinations and in terrorizing civilian population. In West Papua, and it's a two-pronged approach that they're using, basically pressuring and coercing the poor with threats to their well-being, because many poor people know they live at the mercy of what's called the aparat, the army and the police, and threats to their food. And then for the middle and upper classes, and especially the young people, this PR campaign that portrays the general as a cuddly cartoon character. And none of it would be possible without the backing of the incumbent civilian president, who basically bowed to Prabowo and the army after Prabowo's 2019 ultimate coup attempt. So by violence, Prabowo brought himself inside the government, and now that government is preparing to attempt, if necessary through fraud, to install him and give him the ultimate power. And he's talking about modifying the way the presidency works, returning to an older draft of the state constitution, which could make him a virtual dictator if he wants to be.
Alan, before we wrap up, a couple quick questions. Prabowo is the former son-in-law of the longtime authoritarian leader Suharto, responsible for Indonesia invading East Timor. You and I survived the 1991 massacre there, where Indonesian soldiers, armed, trained and financed by the United States, opened fire on defenseless Timorese, killing more than 270 of them. They beat you up, fracturing your skull. Talk about how Prabowo's involvement in Timor, killings in Indonesia as well, and then his supporting of coups led him to where he is today. I was amazed that he was willing to grant you an interview years ago where he talked about becoming a fascist dictator, and where he stands on everything from ISIS to what's happening today in Gaza. After all, Indonesia has the largest Muslim population in the world.
Yes. Well, I met with him twice in 2001, and I was meeting with him because I was investigating two particular murders of civilians, and I wanted to find out what he knew about them. And I think possibly he enjoyed speaking to an adversary. But regarding the Santa Cruz massacre in Timor that we survived, Prabowo said to me that was an imbecilic operation. And he objected to it not because of the hundreds of Timorese the army slaughtered, but because they did it in front of us. And because they did it in front of us and we survived and were able to report it to the outside world, and other foreign witnesses like Max Stahl were able to do the same, we were able to get the U.S. Congress to, over time, through grassroots action in the United States, cut off for a while the U.S. Arms supply to Suharto, which helped to lead to Suharto's downfall, according to Suharto's former security chief, Admiral Sodomo. So Suharto said that was imbecilic. He said, you don't do it in front of outside witnesses. You do a massacre in an isolated rural village where no one will ever know about it. And Prabowo was able to stage his series of coup attempts over the years, in part because he had the support of the Indonesian army, which was in turn backed by the United States. He, in particular, was the Americans' favorite. He described himself as the Americans' fair-haired boy, and he had the support of the Indonesian oligarchy as well. And he certainly has their backing in this election. And with regard to Israel, Prabowo, after he became defense minister, made a special effort to draw Indonesia closer to Israel. The two countries do not have diplomatic relations. The Indonesian population now is outraged by the slaughter, the genocide that Israel is conducting in Gaza. But Prabowo was attempting to bring Israel closer to Indonesia. There was already a covert relationship with Israeli intelligence and with the Israeli military, where intelligence equipment and training was given. And Prabowo, started working with Trump and later Biden to attempt to bring the two countries together, similar to what other predominantly Muslim countries did under the Abraham Accords. Prabowo met with a senior Israeli security advisor. When this came out, he was forced to retreat from this policy. And at this moment, the Indonesian government and Prabowo are posing as if they oppose what Israel is doing. But if he becomes president, there's a very good chance that those relations will grow even closer and perhaps be formalized.
Alan, finally, the former Supreme Court Chief Justice, retired now, tweeted out that you should be captured as you give out this information. Are you concerned about your own safety? I think we just lost our connection to Alan. Alan Nairn, longtime investigative journalist, has been covering Indonesia and occupied East Timor for decades. East Timor has since become an independent nation. We'll link to his new piece in The Intercept, Indonesia State Apparatus is Preparing to Throw Election to a Notorious Massacre General. The election is Wednesday, February 14th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Gaza, to Israel threatening to launch a ground invasion of Rafah, where over a million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge. On Monday, President Biden hosted King Abdullah of Jordan at the White House. During public remarks, Biden initially described Israel's operation in Rafah as, quote, our operation.
Yesterday, our military operation in Rafah, the major military operation in Rafah, should not proceed without a credible plan for ensuring the safety and support of more than 1 million people sheltering there.
Jordan's King Abdullah condemned Israel's plan to attack Rafah and called for a ceasefire and the creation of a Palestinian state.
We cannot afford an Israeli attack on Rafah. It is certain to produce
another humanitarian catastrophe. The situation is already unbearable for over 1 million people who have been pushed into Rafah since the war started. We cannot stand by and let this continue. We need a lasting ceasefire now. This war must end. 7 decades of occupation, death, and destruction have proven beyond any doubt that there can be no peace without a political horizon. Military and security solutions are not the answer. They can never bring peace. Civilians on both sides continue to pay for this protracted conflict with their lives.
We go now to Toronto, where we're joined by Dr. Yasser Khan. He's a Canadian ophthalmologist and eye surgeon who recently returned from a humanitarian surgical mission at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza. Dr. Khan, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can describe what you saw there in Khan Yunis, the level of the injuries, how crowded the European hospital was, the threats people were facing there.
Thank you very much for having me. Well, you know, I look at the impending invasion of Rafah and the attacks of Rafah, and I know, because I've seen it, I know what's going to happen. I know the casualties, and I know how much worse it's going to get. When I was in Khan Yunis a few weeks ago, I've been to over 40 different countries, you know, doing humanitarian work, anywhere from in Africa, Asia, and South America. And there, what I saw in Khan Yunis were the most horrific scenes in my entire life, and I hope I never see them again. It was just, you know, the bombings were going on every few hours at that point in time. The Israeli forces were about a kilometer away, and the mass casualties kept on coming in. And it was mostly, I mean, the majority of the patients that I treated were children, anywhere from the age of 2 to 17. I mean, I saw horrific eye and facial injuries that I've never seen before. Eyes shattered in 2 6-year-old children with shrapnel that I had to take out. Eyes with shrapnel stuck inside. Facial injuries. I saw orthopedic injuries where, you know, limbs just cut off and dangling. I saw abdominal injuries that were just horrific, and it was just mass chaos. There's children on the floor, unattended to. With head trauma, people suturing patients without anesthesia on the ground. It was just mass chaos and really horrific, horrific scenes. And I know that now with the bombing going on in Rafah and scenes of children hanging, exploded, and, you know, half their bodies cut off and hanging on a wall because they've been exploded. I mean, those are scenes going on now. So I know exactly what my colleagues are going through right now in Rafah. And in Gaza, basically.
And doctor, you were working shifts of 12 to 13 hour days. Can you talk about the conditions of the medical staff and the doctors you worked alongside with? Where did you sleep? How were you able to eat? Can you talk about those conditions you faced?
Yeah. Well, the doctors were amazing. I mean, the Palestinian doctors were amazing. Their dedication and their will to resist dying and staying alive was amazing. They're very talented, but they have nothing. There was no antibiotics. There was no painkillers. On the last day I was leaving, we ran out of morphine, which is very important in a lot of orthopedic injuries. So patients were, the whole European Gaza hospital was at the time. Now it's everything I'm seeing, everything I saw is much worse now. But basically, it was overcrowded, about 300-400% over capacity. There was patients and bodies lying all over the hospital floor, inside and outside. They had orthopedic devices coming from their legs or their arms. They were getting infected. They're in pain because they're on the floor, so the conditions weren't very sterile. And if they survived amputation the first time, the infection would get them because then they'd have to be amputated after. A lot of the kids that I saw, and more than 60% of the patients I saw were children. They're thin. They had no fat on them. They're starving because, as you know, Israel has had a food blockade since this war on Gaza started. And so they're all thin with no fat, starving, and they're coming in. And, you know, it was just, and we didn't have enough supplies, enough gauze, enough antibiotics, enough instruments even. The instruments are rusting to kind of you know, deal with the mass trauma.
Dr.
I stayed in the hospital.
Yeah. Dr. Han, this is Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland speaking Monday ahead of a vote on the $95 billion aid package to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan.
Madam President, I want that to sink in. Kids in Gaza are now dying from the deliberate withholding of food. In addition to the horror of that news, one other thing is true. That is a war crime. It is a textbook war crime. And that makes those who orchestrate it war criminals.
That's Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Dr. Han, you're talking about the thinness of the children, of the whole population.
Yeah, well, you know, Amy, it's, you know, from what I saw and what I experienced when I was on the ground speaking to officials, speaking to the doctors there, and this whole, you know, one of the whole aspects of this war in Gaza, you know, the genocidal intent of Israeli politicians, the Israeli army, has been clear. What is really bizarre is they haven't hid it. They have openly called for it. They've openly called for epidemics. And so as a healthcare professional, the attack on the healthcare system has been unprecedented. I mean the viciousness of it, the killing machine that Israel has unleashed on the healthcare system, I think is unprecedented. Hospitals have been bombed. When the doctors have tried to repopulate them, they've been, you know, sniper fire with drones has prevented them from going in. They've attacked the sewage system, the water system, so the sewage mixes with the drinking water, and you get diarrheal diseases, bacterial diseases. You know, cholera, typhoid is not far away. Hepatitis A is epidemic there now. They're living in cramped spaces. They have killed over 300 or 400 healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, paramedics, ambulances have been bombed. This has all been a systematic sort of, by destroying the healthcare system, you're contributing to the genocide. What's going on is now there's 10 to 15,000 bodies that are decomposing. So it's raining season right now in Gaza. So all the rainwater mixes with the decomposing bodies, and that bacteria mixes with the drinking water supply, and you get further disease. They have kidnapped about 40, 45 doctors that have been specifically targeted. They've targeted specifically specialists who are, you know, one-off. So like the one nephrologist in the Gaza Strip was targeted. The pathologist, hospital chiefs and directors have all been targeted through drones or targeted missile strikes. And, you know, so the whole thing is that if the bombings are not going to get you, then disease will surely get you because they're all malnourished. So as you know, if you're malnourished, your immune system is weaker, so you're more susceptible to disease, but there's no antibiotics. You know, the amount of amputations I saw, in children, for example, both arms, one arm, one leg, both eyes gone. You know, both eyes amputated basically out of their eye socket. You know, it's amazing. I mean, it takes about, you know, if this was done properly in a non-war scenario, one amputation in a child will need about 9 to 12 surgeries by the time they're an adult, you know, for prosthetic fitting and whatnot. Now, in this case, first of all, it's a war situation. They've not been done properly. Fair enough, because you have to rush it. But secondly, who's going to take care of these children, mostly children, because their parents are gone, their uncles are dead, their grandfathers and grandmothers are dead. And so, you know, the Israeli killing machine has been vicious. I mean, they've used drones. When I was there, I was speaking to the doctors who were there, and they told me that they've used drones like the Hellfire drone, that is an explosive drone. It fires off these discs once it implodes or explodes. And these discs are very unique and they cause unique amputations. Most amputations occur at the weak points, like the elbow or the knee. But they cause, you know, mid-thigh, mid-arm amputations, which are much more complicated. And they fire off the shrapnel. And you know, from what the doctors are telling me, that, you know, what I believe is that they're using weapons on the civilian population that have never been used before. Because from what I heard, based on my experience, you know, Israel has a very strong defense industry. And buyers like weapons that are battle-tested. So if you can put a label to a new weapon that's battle-tested, that increases the value of it. And they're experimenting with these weapons, from what I've heard and from what I saw, in a civilian dense population. So it's just, it's been vicious, really, really vicious.
Dr. Yasser Khan, I want to thank you for being with us. Canadian ophthalmologist, eye surgeon based in Toronto, Canada, just recently returned from a humanitarian surgical mission at the European hospital Khan Yunis in Gaza. When we come back, we'll be joined by climate scientist Michael Mann, just awarded $1 million in a defamation lawsuit against two right-wing critics. Back in 20 seconds. It's Still Today by Hallelujah Chicken Run Band. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the climate crisis. Dozens were arrested Monday outside President Biden's campaign headquarters in Delaware as members of Sunrise Movement called on him to declare a climate emergency. Some held signs that read, "Fund climate, not genocide." This comes as world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann has been awarded more than $1 million in a defamation lawsuit settled last week. Mann initially filed the case in 2012 against two right-wing critics. Rand Simberg, then with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, wrote that, quote, Mann could be said to be the Jerry Sandusky of climate science, except for instead of molesting children, he's molested and tortured data, unquote. Of course, Sandusky's the convicted child molester and former football coach at Penn State University, where Mann was a professor at the time. Mark Stein, a contributor to National Review, cited Simberg and called Mann's research, quote, fraudulent. Dr. Mann said he hopes the unanimous verdict in his defamation case against the two makes it clear that falsely attacking climate scientists is not protected speech. He's joining us now from Philadelphia, where he's the Presidential Distinguished Professor of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Mann, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain what just happened in this major victory being awarded $1 million by a Washington, D.C. jury after suing these two right-wing climate deniers?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's good to be with you. You know, as you quoted me before, this is a line in the sand. It's one thing to disagree with the findings of scientists. You know, people have the right to do that. It's one thing to criticize scientists. And within the scientific community, good faith criticism, skepticism is a good thing. But what's not allowed, what you can't do, is make false allegations about scientists in an effort, of course, to promote an agenda, in this case, of climate change denialism. And this is something that we've encountered for decades, efforts by the fossil fuel industry and their hired guns to attack and attempt to discredit scientists to prevent meaningful action on climate. And so this is a line in the sand, and I think it goes beyond climate science. I think it also applies to other areas, public health science. Today we see bad faith attacks on, you know, public health scientists like Anthony Fauci, my good friend Peter Hotez. That is not protected speech. You can't engage in false and defamatory attacks on scientists. And so I like to think that this will create some space now, that scientists will feel more comfortable in leaving the laboratory and speaking to the public and policymakers about their science and about the implications of their science, knowing that there are some basic protections.
And I wanted to ask you, in your conversations with fellow scientists, what is the mood or the sense of how these attacks are affecting their ability to do their work?
Well, you know, especially young scientists, what I fear is young scientists see these very visible attacks, these denunciations of their fellow scientists in the public sphere. And that sort of chills the public discourse. It makes them basically afraid to speak out and to speak up. And so I do think that these attacks have had a chilling effect, and that was their intended impact. Of course, the climate change disinformation machine has used vilification as a way to intimidate scientists to create fear that they'll be attacked if they speak out about the implications of their science. That's been going on for far too long. It's now infected our entire body politic, where today misinformation and disinformation runs rampant. And when it comes to the great challenges we face, whether it be climate change or the public health threat of pandemics like COVID-19, it is absolutely essential that scientists feel free to speak to the public and to policymakers about these mounting threats. And I hope, once again, that this decision will create a little bit more space now for my fellow scientists to do that.
And do you see your case setting precedent for political leaders who attack climate science, to attack climate science? And how badly were you injured? I mean, this horror of comparing you to this known molester who destroyed so many young men's lives at Penn State.
Yeah, well, you know, I was certainly, there was an emotional toll that it took on me for certain. You know, it didn't prevent me from speaking out about the climate crisis. I have embraced that opportunity. My recent book, Our Fragile Moment, is my latest attempt to communicate the threat of climate change to the public and to policymakers. I've been able to do that. But at the same time, it's taken an emotional toll, it once again has sort of created this chilling effect where other scientists, seeing me attacked in this way, have probably backed off and have shied away from the spotlight. And we all pay the price when scientists don't feel empowered to speak out about the implications of their science.
I want to bring into this conversation Mark Hertzgaard, executive director of Covering Climate Now and the environment correspondent for The Nation, where his new piece is headlined, "It's the 2024 Election Season. Where's the Climate Story?" Welcome back, Mark, to Democracy Now! Lay out what you're calling for in this election year 2024.
Thanks, Amy. And I have to say that the comments that Michael Mann is making right now about how the climate denialism has intimidated scientists into not speaking about their findings, that has happened exactly the same way within our profession of the news media. For too many years, many of our colleagues in the media have been intimidated by these right-wing attacks and have come to think that, well, I don't really understand climate science. I guess I better not talk about it. And you see that now in the election, 2024 election, which is that there's a lot of coverage, obviously, about the campaigns, especially here in the United States at the presidential level, but very little connection of the fact that these elections are essentially going to shape humanity's climate future, and not just in the United States. About half of the world's population is entitled to vote in various elections around the world. We just heard Alan Nairn's report from Indonesia. Very important election there. India is coming up, European Union, U.S., South Africa, Mexico. These elections are going to decide which governments are in power or not in power over this next critical five-year period when we absolutely have got to bend the climate pollution trajectory down if we're going to preserve a livable planet on this future. So these elections could not be more important from a climate perspective. And yet a lot of the media is still not making that connection. And I can tell you that part of the reason is a fear on their part. I just had this conversation the other day with a very prominent journalist, fear that we will look partisan if we point out, for example, that here in the United States, one of the major political parties is still essentially denying climate change. That's the Republicans, of course. And Donald Trump, who has pledged to drill, baby, drill from the first day back if he were to be returned to the White House. It's not our job as journalists to censor ourselves because one party or one candidate decides that they're going to deny climate science. We owe it to the public to report that to the public without fear or favor.
And I wanted to ask you, Mark, in terms of how the Democratic Party has been handling the issue of climate change during this election season, because there couldn't be a more stark difference between the two candidates in terms of climate science, at least in terms of their acknowledgement of the crisis that we're facing. Right. But is the Democratic Party really pushing forth as strongly as it could on this issue?
You know, Juan, I think it's hard to know I because so much of what we in the public hear about from the Democratic Party or from the White House is filtered again through the prism of the news media. And, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act, certainly the biggest climate legislation ever passed, probably in the world, certainly here in the United States, and passed, by the way, by a Democratic president through a Congress that is still has a lot of Republican control in it. The White House has been very frustrated that the general public does not know about that. And the White House has tried and tried, it says, to put Biden on the road to talk about this. And it's not getting the kind of press coverage that at least I would have expected. So I think that you're certainly right that there is a huge contrast between a Democratic and a Republican approach to this. Is Biden's climate record perfect? Far from it. The U.S. is still now the biggest oil and gas producer in the world. You know, he green-lighted the Willow Project, oil project up in Alaska. But he just put a pause on liquid natural gas export facilities across the Gulf Coast. So as voters, I think it's very important for people who are out there as citizens to remember that, to quote my colleague Rebecca Solnit, when you're thinking about your vote is not a Valentine, with all due respect to Valentine's tomorrow. Your vote's not a Valentine. It's a chess move. You don't have to approve of everything a certain candidate does in order to say, I'm still going to vote. If you care about climate, vote. If you care about fairness, vote. If you care about peace, vote.
This week, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez marked the 5-year anniversary of the introduction of the Green New Deal.
We are going to go, and we have to go to every single frontline community and ensure that they are not left behind. We're going to create millions of unionized jobs across the United States of America. We are going to revamp our transmission lines, install solar, commit to geothermal, and we are going to transition this country to clean and renewable energy and create a sustainable working class in the process of doing it.
Mark Hertzgard, we just have 30 seconds, but again, that's AOC celebrating now 5 years since Green New Deal was introduced.
And that Green New Deal is what gave us the Inflation Reduction Act, somewhat trimmed down from the original vision of the Green New Deal, but that's where, again, elections are important. AOC ran, took on a moderate Democrat who everybody said was unbeatable. She beat him and injected all of this new energy and great ideas into the American political discourse, like the Green New Deal. And I think that's exactly why we in the press have to be paying much more attention to the climate issue here in 2024.
As the Northeast is shut down by what is expected to be a monster storm. It just recently started snowing here in the city. The schools are closed from here to Boston. Mark Hertzgard, Executive Director of Covering Climate Now, will link to your new article in The Nation. It's the 2024 election season. Where's the climate story? And thanks so much to Michael Mann, Professor of Earth and Environmental Science at University of Pennsylvania, just awarded $1 million in a defamation lawsuit. Happy birthday to Brendan Allen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
101.3 FM, Pittsburgh. My name's Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, what is The Angry Young Man, you may ask? Well, I'm The Angry Young Man, Anthony Cacciato, here to talk with you guys about some things to be angry about. Or, you know, what can we do about those things that we're angry about? Now, the world is an angry place, in the wise words of Heath Ledger's Joker. But, you know, it's there's kind of a rationale behind heading this whole thing up. You know, there's not a lot of public affairs talk on WRCT. Kind of talking about what's going on. What are people talking about, or what are people not talking about? You know, that's a big issue I find. That's, you know, that when we have a lot of issues in the world, you can't really solve them by complaining about them. You know, you can complain about them all you want and be angry about them. You can be an angry young man or woman or angry person, but it doesn't do you any good unless you kind of dig into what's going on and talk about it. So, you know, That's kind of what I'm hoping to do here. You know, throughout this next couple of weeks, we're going to have some guests coming in to talk about the issues, niche, front page, whatever have you. Whatever you guys want to hear more so is the thing, too, because, you know, what's a public affairs show if it's not talking about the affairs of the public, and specifically around here? So, you know, that's another thing. I implore you members of the community to reach out to us over here at WRCT just to say what you want to hear us talk about, you know, what we should probably kind of discuss as the issues of the community, be it the university, be it Pittsburgh, or the nation on the whole. And I do want to remind you that our phone number that you can call us at, unfortunately, we can't patch through calls right now. That's a big regret of mine, because eventually, once we're able to do that, love to have you guys on to talk. But that's going to be 412-268-9728. After the show at 12 o'clock, you know, if you'd like to call in, you know, give your 2 cents, I'd be more than happy to talk to you. But for the time being, unfortunately, can't call you in, but we'll try to incorporate whatever we hear, you know, into our future programming, at least for this show. Do want to be very clear at the outset. This, whatever is being spoken on this show, is not representative of WRCT on the whole, but rather my, Anthony Cacciato's, personal opinions, thoughts, ravings and ramblings of an angry young man here. I mean, kind of going into the meat of it now, you know, it's just me today. Just kind of what, why be angry? You know, what, sure, you know, have a show about being an angry young man, but why are you angry? Depends on who you ask. There's definitely, I'm sure you could think about different ways that, I'm having some mic trouble here, sorry. Just a moment. There we go. Sorted. Sorry about that. You know, why be angry? Well, again, depends on who you ask. If you ask me, there's a couple things you can be angry about. I mean, look at the state of government. I don't think many people would call the current state of government functional, say the least, or it highly functional. I mean, look at where our debt is at. We're in the billions, well beyond the billion mark. You know, you look at what we're willing to spend here and there, and you have people that are still financially struggling as a result of COVID-19 pandemic, you know, labor shortage. You have small businesses that are just kind of eking by if they were lucky enough to make it past the pandemic. I mean, I could think of so many businesses between Pittsburgh and where I'm from in New York that weren't able to kind of hold down the fort through the tide, and, you know, it got swept away, and it's sad. And a lot of these backbone of the community mom and pop shops that just couldn't. It's genuinely something to me that it concerns me that, you know, in the midst of all this, you